KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno and online at kpfa.org. It is 7 p.m. Stay tuned now for Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
From Pacifico Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihira Zazan, and with me here is Khalil Bendit.
On this week's program, Algeria also has a major election.
Over the last decade, people have just lost trust in the political process, in the elections, and they have seen people who get elected and to do what? Mostly enrich themselves. And so what people have turned to now, and this has been going on for the last decade, is they just take things in their own hands, they riot. There is not a single day where there were no riots or strikes in Algeria.
We'll have an in-depth conversation with Algerian-born Professor Azzedine Layashi of St. John's University about the results of the May 10th elections and their significance. Later in the program, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa contributor Amir Soltani will be talking to Leila Azem Zangana about her newest book, The Enchanter, Nabokov and Happiness, in which she pays tribute to her favorite author, Vladimir Nabokov. All that coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
In recent months, the presidential elections in Egypt have grabbed the world's attention. But one round of elections that came and went without much notice was that of parliamentary elections in Algeria. Khalil Bendib spoke with Professor Azzedine Layashi of St. John's University about the May 10th parliamentary election results in Algeria to try to understand them in light of Algeria's own recent history and against a background of unfolding revolutions in North Africa and the rest of the Arab world.
Professor Layashi, last week Algeria saw the first important elections since the start of the so-called Arab Spring. The government was lauding this occasion as proof that, unlike other North African countries, the Arab Spring was happening in Algeria in an orderly and progressive fashion. And these elections were proof positive of that. First of all, were these clean elections by and large, in your opinion, and can the results be trusted? We hear that international observers gave their caution. They called the election satisfactory, but then there have been many accusations of fraud by participants.
Yes, exactly. That's indeed. And it has been the case in all elections. There's always people who, in the field, who definitely see fraud, see some tweaking of the results, and also the whole process in terms of picking the candidates and who is in, who is not, what parties are in, what parties are not, and so on. So the whole process has been marred with questions and doubts. So this time here, you have like 500 international observers who did not see much in terms of visible fraud, but did not have also access to all the information that they wanted, especially what they call the consolidated list of voters. So they returned with a good impression overall, but people in the field, especially political parties, leaders, several believe that the results are not what they should be. And as far as the population is concerned in general, it does not matter. And this is the biggest problem for Algeria, is that people, the overwhelming majority, did not seem to be concerned by the vote because they have lost trust in the process itself.
That's what we were hearing before the election. And then we heard this number, which I would like you also to tell us whether you think it's an authentic or more or less close to a reality number. The number is 43%, or 42.9%. The rate of participation of the electorate, if true, was much higher than anticipated. Algerians, as you're saying, were supposed to be quite disaffected with the whole electoral process. And the government was very anxious not to be embarrassed by a minimal participation.
Yes, because they already had faced that situation in 2007.
Yes.
When the participation rate was 37%. And they were up in arms. They could not understand why. I mean, it got to a point where the Interior Ministry sent out letters to all the people who didn't show up to vote, asking them why. You know, of course, people didn't care to respond. So this time here, they really needed an acceptable number of participation. And I don't think they could not go beyond what they have put out, which is the 43%. But according to many people, according to many accounts, from people interviewed by the media, from colleagues of mine in the field, telling us that the participation rate was a lot lower than that. Now, if you take into account 18% of ballots that were invalid ballots, which means blank ballots, many people have voted just to go and just cast the vote because they were afraid or they needed to just do the act, but without actually voting for anybody. And so if that is counted as also an abstention, even though the ballot was cast, but in fact for no one, then the percentage is a lot lower. So we're talking about, as far as my impression is concerned, anywhere between 20 and 30%, no more than that.
What would prompt people to go vote when they don't really feel like voting?
You know, the tendency, just like probably in the United States, the older tend to vote more than the younger and so on, out of duty, out of loyalty, out of sense of doing something that is that one has to do as a citizen and so on. So they needed to go and just cast the vote, say, okay, I have exercised my right to vote. I have responded to the calls from the government or the parties to vote, but I have not made up my mind as to, you know, whom I'm really supporting. As a matter of fact, the list was so long of candidates. That it was impossible for anyone to know, not even a smallest fraction of the people on the ballot. There were only the big names that people have become familiar with, the heads of the main parties, and that's it. So beyond that, there was nobody else that could recognize. And I would assume that they feel good about casting the vote or the ballot itself, but not necessarily picking a vote. And it could also very well be a protest vote. Some people who would go and cast the ballot and deface the ballot itself with a pen, writing something on it, messages and so on. So those are also invalid. And this has become customary in recent elections, where people express their disagreement with the process by writing messages on the ballot and then putting it in the envelope and so on. So there is no doubt in anybody's mind today, even those who rule the country, that there is a malaise with regard to the political process itself in Algeria. There is a problem. The thing is that the leaders in their campaign, you know, before the elections were calling on Algerians to do what is right for the country. Some people have even called this the second most important act next to the war for independence. This doesn't make sense to me, of course. But it was a big call for a duty to keep Algeria peaceful, whole, and shielded from the chaos that has hit the region in the wake of the Arab Spring. So they would be pointing to, without necessarily naming things probably, but pointing to situations, especially in Libya, and also how things have become chaotic in Egypt and then Yemen, and then what is happening in Syria, and say, do we really want that? And the second point also was not necessarily said explicitly all the time, but was an undercurrent or an implicit element of the discourse, do we want the Islamists in power? Mm-hmm. So therefore, please vote in the name of unity, in the name of peace, in the name of stability, and vote FLN in the name of continuity, in the name of guaranteeing the social contract, whatever that is, you know, that it is maintained and so on, so that we will not take a chance with a drastic change as has been experienced next door.
And the FLN, of course, being the National Front of Liberation that has dominated Algerian politics for more than 50 years now, ever since it
Exactly. That's the party that led, that unified the people to rise up against the French in 1954, and then after independence, it became the only party that was legal all the way up to 1989. After that, multi-partism was finally adopted. And the FLN did not do very well in the first elections because a wave of Islamist parties, especially one, the Front of Islamic Salvation, did capture most of the vote of those who voted in the first municipal elections and the first parliamentary elections before they were canceled and then the Islamist Party was banned. Then the FLN slowly was able to come back. The FLN itself did not probably exercise much power for most of Algeria's independence because it was the army that was the real power holder in Algeria. But the FLN was a major instrument in mobilizing society, in organizing things, in making sure that things are done according to whatever plan was for the revolution after independence. But in recent years, and in the context of multi-parties, and also in the context also where the army has been slightly pushed aside, not much, but slightly, the FLN has become a political force and has imposed its own weight on politics. And this is much more recent than not.
Well, you started retelling the story of what happened after the political system was open, 1988-89, you haven't talked about what the tragic consequence.
Oh, yes, of course.
What happened after the cancellation of the election.
You are absolutely right. And that's part also of the equation of these elections, as a matter of fact, because in 1992, when the Front of Islamic Salvation was definitely going to win the overwhelming majority in the parliament and parliamentary elections, before the second balloting, the runoff elections, to take place, the army intervened and pushed the president to resign, and then the elections were canceled. So what happened is that the Islamists were denied the victory that they had earned by way of voting. They decided to try to get it back by the way of arms. And so they started an armed rebellion that was terrible. That was terrible. One of the worst, probably, in the world. Post-independence things, and over a period of 10 years, 200,000 people were killed, many times in the most atrocious way. Terrible things were done. Sometimes entire villages were decimated at night, and the women, children, elderly, nobody was left out in this process. And a huge number of population movement from areas that were hotbeds of this rebellion and so on. And so that was a traumatic experience of 10 years. And if anybody now speaks about the Arab Spring, some commentators would say that the Algerian Spring had begun, in fact, in 1988, when the youth started rioting massively across the country. There was a repression, very harsh repression, within a week that left 500 people killed, mostly young people. Then the political opening happened. And that political opening that happened starting early 89 was a marvelous opening. Suddenly we moved from one party system to 62 parties, multi-party, freedom of association, freedom of the press for the first time, independent media was born and so on. So it was like 2 years of wonderful experience in democratization and political liberalization, not to say democracy itself, but Algeria was on its way, we thought, towards a brighter political future. And of course, when the Islamists happened to be the best organized, the bigger mobilizers, the most eloquent as far as the masses were concerned about the societal project that they had in mind, that became a concern to the powers that be. And of course, their victory was stopped in its track. And then Algeria descended into those, what became known as the dark decade of the 1990s. And after 10 years of war, then an amnesty program was proposed. The process began in 1997, 1998. By the time the current president, Bouteflika, became president in 1999, the deal was done, and there was a first amnesty program that amnestied all rebels under certain conditions, but in general it was a pretty lenient kind of amnesty. Anybody who was involved in this was amnestied, and would be no questioning, nothing, just come back, put down the weapons, and then everything will be fine. So thousands of people have done that. The problem with this amnesty program, there were two of them, 1999 and 2005, was that it amnestied everyone, which means not only the Islamists, but also state security services, who were accused by many people of having done also terrible things to also innocent people. And so on. So everybody was amnestied. There was never a debate on what happened and who did what to whom. So it is not, even though we call it reconciliation, that has never really happened. But what is remarkable is that, yes, peace came back to Algeria. there were still active group in Algeria, as a matter of fact, for the whole region, the Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, which is a group that was, in fact, an Algerian group, remnant of the armed rebellion that transformed itself into a subsidiary, if you want, of Al-Qaeda, and then became part of the network of Al-Qaeda. And then now it's acting in the entire North African and Sahel region, trying to, of course, overthrow the existing government and to also push out all foreign forces from the region and so on. But in general, the level of violence has gone down, I would say, by 85% in Algeria. So peace has returned, and people started trusting in the political process and new parties and so on. But in the long run, they realize that this political process has lost its meaning, that the new parties are not representing them, are not talking in their names, they're not responding to their calls, to their needs, that the parliament has absolutely no power. It is a presidential system where the power formally resides in the hands of the president, who nominates and appoints the cabinet and the prime minister, but then even the president has not enjoyed the authority the constitution has given him, because as many people who know Algeria have commented, the real power has been in the hands of the army and the security services. And so disillusionment has set in over the last, I would say, decade, and people have just lost trust in the political process, in the elections, and they have seen people who get elected and to do what? Mostly enrich themselves, find jobs for their relatives and friends. It has just become a typical crony state, and then people's demands and needs have not been met, the most urgent ones. And so what people have turned to now, this has been going on for the last decade, is they just take things in their own hands, they riot. There is not a single day where there were no riots or strikes in Algeria. And as a matter of fact, a number was recently given by the state itself. It says that in 2011, there were 11,000 events that included professional strikes, rural and urban protests, and they are, I call them mini riots, and also more recently, an increasing number of self-immolation, especially among the young and unemployed. And now, this election seem to most people as just a charade. It's just things don't add up here. The government has tried to react to the Arab Spring in its own way. First of all, it is cognizant that people are not ready to fight another war against the state because of the trauma of the 1990s. Second, they doled out billions of dollars last year, probably around late February, if not early March. The president announced $280 billion fund to boost economic activity, to increase employment of the youth, to provide more housing and do a lot of social projects and so on. So just the infusion of cash. And let's remember that from 2000 probably to 2005, already $400 billion were put in there, and mostly going towards infrastructural type of investment, roads and housing and things like that, and not much, unfortunately, in terms of creating an economy that is less reliant on hydrocarbons. So now people have learned that if they protest and if they do it on the streets, what has been happening in small villages, people don't get water all the time, and sometimes they don't see it for a week or 2 weeks. If it's a little bit more than usual, then they will just go burn a few tires on a national roadway and block traffic for a few days. They may attack also the city hall of a little tiny village, and then what they get is a quick response. So the state has become a fireman type of authority. There is a little fire, go put it out. I would say, you were missing water for 5 weeks, you said? Sorry about that. Tomorrow is going to start. You're going to get it every single day. If there is a problem, call us. Here is the number. And so on and so on. And the strikes also, and they are still going on. And there are people who are doing also hunger strikes now in Algeria, demanding better work condition or revamping of the rules of hiring or firing or whatever things, and a lot of different aspects of employment in almost all sectors, education, health, and so on. And so if people persist long enough, they tend to get a response from the state. And so this has become the mode of operation for people. It's not the political process. It's not political parties. It's not what we call civil society. It's not elections. It's not petitioning the government by letter and waiting. It is by going out on the streets and just protesting and even going as far as hunger strikes to that length to be able to get a response.
So things are happening on a parallel track.
Absolutely, and not necessarily communicating.
Right. So on the one hand, on paper, there are all these elections and the structure, and this government.
Yeah, Algeria looks good from the outside. Mm. Absolutely. And also they increase the number of women in on mandatory 30% of the party and so on. And so it looks good. Now we have a lot more women in parliament. It's great. Much less Islamists because they have lost 30 seats, by the way, in this election. And the report by the observers looks good. So, you know, so everything is fine.
And that's Professor Azzedine Layashi of St. John's University speaking with Khalil Bendib about the Algerian legislative election, which took place on May 10th. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Beyond the sobering picture that you paint of Algeria and how things are happening a little bit more outside of the official framework, still it's interesting to try to speculate about the results. Some analysts have been, perhaps those who have a little more belief in the actual results, have tried to understand this lack of popularity of the Islamists, if that's actually what we are seeing. And that would be very interesting if this is actually happening, because it would be an exception. And some people have speculated that perhaps is it that Algeria is a decade or two ahead of the curve. They've seen some of the Islamists at work, not impressed with them. Is that what we're seeing possibly?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point, yes. In one sense, Algeria is ahead of the curve, but on the other sense, there were other elements in the picture also that we need to take into account. First of all, yes, the Islamists started taking part in the political process, and we call Islamists those deemed moderate Islamists, those who have condemned violence and who would never use violence, those that got the stamp of approval from the state in the 1990s, in the middle of the war. So they were elected into office, and also for a long period of time, there were like an average of 7 ministries, a member of the Islamist party heading those ministries. The problem is that the institutions don't have much power. That's the thing. You don't have parliament that functions like American Congress. So you have a parliament whose power is extremely curtailed. So the Islamists did find a way to express themselves in parliament and try to sway policy on especially social issues and issues dealing with culture and so on. And also they did have an impact on the personal status laws. But not much beyond that. So what has happened
is the laws that impact women, especially in the
exactly, yeah, yeah.
Of the
these are the laws regarding marriage and divorce and inheritance and so on. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So you're saying they did manage to have some impact on those, and maybe perhaps a negative impact.
Yes, exactly. On these limited areas, the problem of the Islamists is that one, that the institutions where they ended up serving had limited power. Second of all, there was a tactical mistake, probably, maybe for them it was a rational thing to do, was that the biggest Islamist party in parliament, which is the Movement of Society for Peace, the MSP, it used to be called Hamas in the 90s before it changed its name, became part of a pro-government alliance which means working with the National Liberation Front and with the RND, the National Rally for Democracy, which is like a half-brother of the FLN. So it worked with us, supported the government, and 3 months before the elections, I was in Algeria, as a matter of fact, at that time. The MSP decided to quit the alliance and to join the opposition. So, as if they were taking people for, you know.
Fools, yeah. So the most mainstream Islamist party that used to be part of the government 3 months before the election actually decided to be the opposition.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Jumped ship and then created a coalition called the Green Alliance with two other Islamist parties. And then also, 3 months before the elections, the government allowed the emergence of new parties, among them Islamists. So we ended up having 7 Islamist parties. So the Islamist force was diluted, dispersed. First of all, the Islamist parties have shown that they were unable to deliver on their promises in the long term. Second of all, that they're highly divided. Third of all, there were many cases of corruption involving known members of these Islamist parties that came to the fore in recent months.
Well, what do you know?
All this, so they became part of the system itself. And at the same time, let's also remember that society has become more Islamized, more religious along these years. This is something highly noticeable. So the appeal or the field on which the Islamist parties need to work has completely shrunk. Then in the background also, for some people who are reluctant to vote for Islamists, there is always the terrible decade for which the Islamists are blamed. So in all this, I'm not surprised that they have lost. When people were speculating months before the elections that the Islamists were going to win big in Algeria, I said, look again. Look again. They will be lucky if they keep the seat that they have. And in fact, they lost.
The bloom is off the rose in Algeria.
Absolutely. The bloom is off the rose. Some people have said these Islamist parties who have the stamp of approval of the government are not really representing the true Islamist force in Algeria. The true Islamist force in Algeria is represented by the banned party, the Front of Islamic Salvation, which has been denied. This is part of the amnesty program. Any possibility of ever returning to politics.
When you look at Egypt, the Muslim Brothers managed to recycle themselves under different guises. Has the Front of Islamic Salvation, which has been banned for the past 20 years or so, has it not played that game? Has it not?
No, there were rumors that one Islamist party that has been proposed by a famous person in Algeria for a long time, I forgot the name that they gave it. The government did not want to accept it because it was suspected as a new way to channel back the feast leadership and so on. So the government does not want it. The government believes that the FIS still constitutes a threat to the system, and therefore it's not possible. And there have been daily demands from members of the party to be able to resume, to regain their political rights. And the government just does not want to hear. Now, the difference between the FIS and the Muslim Brothers, I think, is big.
Yes,
experience.
Yes.
You know, the Muslim Brothers go back to the 1920s.
Right.
And they did go the violent way at first and then changed. And then they abandoned it a long time ago. And they remained in the opposition. And they participate in the political process as independents, always independents. And one of the biggest mistakes that Mubarak made was during the last legislative elections that they held. It was in the late 2000s. The Muslim Brothers had around 80 to 84 seats in parliament as independent, and they were participating. They were really participating, and they were not creating any problem. And they were having some impact on some issues. The mistake was that in the last parliamentary elections, the presidential party took almost all seats, and the Muslim Brothers lost completely what they had, which means the opposition was completely shut out. And this is something that I'm afraid, you know, as I wrote a comment to a friend recently by email in Algeria, and I just told him what's happening in Algeria just reminds me what Mubarak did when he let his party take more seats and kick out even the Muslim Brothers out of there. That was a very big tactical mistake. And the Algerians here now with the FLN with 221 seats in a 465-seat parliament is just something that is not going to be sustainable, even in the short term. Because the FLN, along with the half-brother, the RND, would have the majority. They would not need the Islamists at all to form the coalition necessary to support the government. This is a dangerous path. The government, of course, responds that by saying, look, we have just legalized 20 new parties. What do you want from us? Now we have new parties and we have young people in the parliament and so on, but who are the power holders? We still have people who go back to the war against France, including the president himself. Mujahideen, as we call them, the warriors for Algeria's independence, who are still holding on to most of the power in Algeria. And the youth is shut out. I just looked at the results of a political party. It's called the Party of the Young. It gained 2 seats.
And this is against the backdrop of politicians like the president himself saying we need new blood. We need people in their 30s.
Yeah, he did say it exactly. Right. But what he meant was just creating new parties. And then all the commotion that happened about who is going to be on the list. Exactly, because the FLN has come back stronger than ever since its major defeat in 1991, and now there is very little need to work with this supposed opposition that is allowed into a parliament.
Explain to us the difference, ideologically speaking, beyond the fact that the FIS, Front of Islamic Salvation, other than the use of violence, what is the significant ideological difference between the FIS and the more mainstream Islamist movement that is allowed to play on the national scene? You say a lot of people suspect that there's a still strong support for the FIS and not for these other Islamists who are allowed by the government to run for election.
Yeah. One thing is that I'm not sure whether the FIS will be able to recapture the popularity it had before, but unless, you know, it plays its cards extremely well and at the right time might be able to regain some of it. As far as the ideological differences, you see, even the FIS itself was not necessarily a homogeneous group itself. It was an amalgamation of a variety of currents, and that's why it's called the Front of Islamic Salvation, not a single unitary entity. But in general, you have the kind of influence of the Muslim Brothers that did cover the entire region, you know, for most of the 1960s and 70s and so on, and that left its imprint on all these parties. The MSP said to be much closer to the Muslim Brothers than others. And so in terms of ideological differences, it's very difficult to really know exactly where they stand on a variety of issues because most of their discourse is pretty general. Now, on certain issues, the FIS, when it was in its heyday, it did not want any part of the system to remain. It wanted tabula rasa, which means clean slate, destroy the existing state, get rid of the entire leadership, decapitate the army, and then start afresh with an Islamic state fashioned according to God knows what kind of scheme they had in mind. That was the message. That was the thing that brought it popularity because it wanted a clean break from the system. Now, as far as Hamas is concerned, or as far as Ennahda or Islah, the other Islamist parties in parliament today, these parties, they accept the system and they accept to work with the system from inside, thinking that they will be able to generate change, slow change, peacefully, and they would also be able to garner even more popular support by Islamizing society. And then one day the state will be ripe for them to just collect, pick up, and just take it and run with it. And, of course, that has not worked for them. So in terms of strategies, there is a clear distinction between the two. In terms of ideological, if you want to put them on an ideological spectrum from, you know, a moderate to less moderate, then you would put the FIS as less moderate and then the other as much. In terms of moderation, meaning working with the system or not working with the system. So the parties that are in place today in the political process in Algeria are parties that have accepted to work with the system and even supported the system, as the case of the MSP that was part of the pro-coalition government for a decade, if not more, until 3 months before the elections. It decided that it didn't want to have anything to do with it, thinking that it would become the Ennahda, Tunisia's Ennahda of Algeria, and win big time. And, of course, that backfired against them. They lost so badly because they did not think that people had a brain, that people could see the game, that people could realize that these parties have not served them, and so on. Now, the FIS had a true revolutionary kind of message. It wanted to overthrow the existing order, at first peacefully, and then when that did not work through the ballot box, then by way of violence. The thing is that it lost control of that because the FIS had an armed wing called the AIS, the Army of Islamic Salvation. But then there was a radical group that was born completely independent from the FIS, even opposed to the FIS, which is the GIA, which is another amalgamation of radical groups called the Armed Islamic Groups. The French initials are GIA.
Yes.
And these were the ones that did the most terrible things and that gave Islamism the most terrible qualifications. So, and then there were other groups, of course, that were born and that were acting in their own names and not necessarily in the FIS name. And then the FIS got all the blame. Of course, in the end, it was the one that had started this. It is the one that didn't know that. And because it had that revolutionary message and was not obtained by the way of the ballots, would be obtained by the way of the bullets. And, of course, taking on the state head-on was not a working strategy. At first, the Algerian state was completely off balance, did not know what to do, how to do it, because its army was just like the armies of other states, trained to deal with external threats, not internal threats of this magnitude. But over the long run, they managed not only to better the way of fighting back, but also to infiltrate and help them destroy some of these groups, such as the GIA, which was heavily infiltrated by the security services, and then infightings and so on, and did the rest of the job.
Not to mention the tendency of these violent, radical Islamist groups to be their own worst enemies and abuse a lot of the populations that were supporting them.
That is absolutely right. People in poor villages who had believed in them, yes. You know, that's part of the drama, exactly. Because in many areas, people that have supported the Islamists in the first three elections ended up paying a heavy price. And that was something that people are still living with in terms of a traumatic experience. Many, many, many families have been touched. And with 200,000 people killed, and still today, 7,000 to 10,000 people are unaccounted for. So you can just imagine
the lack of the trauma,
of willingness today for the Algerians to go up in the street and start all over again. It might take another generation to recover, and maybe another revolutionary momentum will start, but not with the generation that went through the 1990s. And the young today, you know, the young, the people who were not old enough to experience the 1990s, you know, are the young who are, you know, restless. They're the ones who are looking for jobs. They're the ones who are demonstrating. They're the ones who are leading the mini riots in the small towns and villages and so on. And they're the ones who absolutely have no connection with the political process whatsoever.
In other words, Algeria continues to be unique in so many ways, even within its own region.
Yeah. The thing is that, you know, Algeria, I'm generally an optimist person, but sometimes, you know, certain things just makes you think twice about that optimism.
Yes.
Algeria has all the assets to really do very, very well. And if only those who are in power decide to pass on the torch to the young, and not necessarily the political parties, give it to the technocrats, and also if the Algerians can really have a very good, sincere, open public debate on where Algeria needs to go and what needs to be done. Algeria has the wealth to start an economy that is less reliant on oil, has the youth that are educated, has a huge pool of youth, and 70% are 30 and less year old, and has the geography, has the proximity to Europe, and could serve as a wonderful link between the East and the West, between the South and Sub-Saharan Africa and Europe, and so on. And a lot of bright people willing to really do the work. But there is this political deadlock. We are in a free zone. Things are frozen in time.
Azzedine Layashi is professor of government and politics at St. John's University. He spoke with Khalil Bendib about the May 10th parliamentary elections in Algeria. To learn more, visit vomina.org or jadalia.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. The Enchanter, Nabokov and Happiness, writer Leyla Azam Zangane explores happiness in the works of Vladimir Nabokov, weaving in elements of memoir, biography and criticism, as well as fiction. Guardian of London describes The Enchanter as, quote, a playful, semi-fictionalized sequence of elaborations or variations on the experience of being a passionate Nabokov reader. End of quote. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa contributor Amir Sultani spoke with Ms. Zangane about the process of writing The Enchanter and how she related to Nabokov's work as an Iranian expatriate.
Lilo, you start by talking about your dread of reading. Can you tell us a little bit about where that came from?
Yes, well, I think it's when one is too much in love with a thing or a being. It's frightening. And I think my problem was that I was just too infatuated with language. And just today I was thinking again, I was looking at someone knowing that she's a very fast reader and thinking perhaps my problem with reading is just liking language too much and therefore getting just caught up in the detail and the twists and turns and wanting to read and reread until you finally get every detail. So it's really about an excessive case of infatuation.
How did this infatuation begin?
Well, it began because I was an exiled Iranian child. I was born in Paris, actually, but we had very briefly lived in Iran, and we came out at the time of the revolution. And I think for my family, there was a clear sense that the only thing that could be saved, really, was culture and books, especially music, too. But books had a very special place in my upbringing. And there was a sense that books could be carried in you at all times, like little treasures that gleamed. And it was not also, we grew up, of course, in France. I mean, I did. So it was French books, but also it was Persian literature and Anglo-American literature as well. Those were the three poles. And so I think it started by seeing my mother read and my father, and then, for instance, hearing my father recite a lot of poetry. And those things really made an awful lot of sense to me. And I began to feel much more at ease in the land of stories than I ever did as a child in school, where, in fact, because I was in exile, I always felt a bit weird or a bit on the sidelines or a bit of a nerd. And somehow, of course, in the land of stories, I was perfectly at home. But I think it's a very banal story in terms of, you know, growing up in nerdland, that you would begin to love stories so much. And I would dream, I would daydream all the time. If I wasn't reading, I was daydreaming. And I was imagining myself as being one character in those endless stories. I was just being invented on and on and on.
So what is the relationship between language and exile?
Oh, there's a very powerful relationship. First of all, I think one, you know, especially a child, in my strange case, I was not born in Iran. Therefore, the Persian language that I speak is really, in a sense, my only real connection to Iran. I would say it's twofold. One is through the Persian language that I speak in a peculiar way. My mother has always said, why does my child sound Armenian in Persian? Because I have a funny French lilt in my Persian. But also, again, stories. It's absolutely imagination. It's the way that I have heard a certain country described in so many stories at so many dinners, and really probably my compiled and combined images of the country have nothing to do with the country itself. It's completely, it's an imaginary Iran designed and created by me. So it's odd, and it exists through images, and images, of course, wind up existing through language. And then, of course, we also had to speak a number of different languages in order to survive, because you had your cousins in America who would make fun of you because you couldn't say "it sucks" with the right accent, or you had your grandmother who only spoke Persian, or somebody else who was exiled in Italy. Therefore, you had to speak many languages, and I think growing up straddling these languages gives you a particular sense of the texture and the fabric of languages. It makes them a bit more alien, paradoxically. Every language I feel I'm looking at as an outsider, even French, which is probably my strongest language, and I'm very conscious that I speak French like a French person. So I think seeing, feeling the language as an outsider makes you conscious of the sensuousness of the language and makes you want to play with it, really as if it were paint or clay.
Well, and where does this playfulness of yours come in? I mean, most people who are in exile and have a relationship with language, they zoom in on sorrow and grief and mourning. You go for joy and happiness. Where does that come from?
Well, I think it's because we've all seen such combined sorrow, I think, that what drew me always, again, perhaps going back to childhood and to being a super sensitive child, I was always the smallest sad turn of events in a fairy tale used to make me feel just atrociously sad, and everything felt excessively imprinted on my mind and my imagination, so that anything, the obverse was true as well. If there was a glimmer of light or color, the color seemed even more real and more vivid if it was told in a story, if it could be read and reread again. Therefore, I think that I was naturally drawn to those things. I had seen a lot of difficult stories around me, as we all have, and much, much suffering, much, much loss. So I guess a part of me, and that I think explains the attraction to Nabokov, a part of me was interested in literature, but literature and what it had of that was most enchanting. And Nabokov, many people think of him as the writer of dark stories and dank plots and character and plot lines, and of course it's not true at all. And what he has said, he has a beautiful line about literature, and he says, the best novels are fairy tales. And I think it's one of the coolest definitions of literature, and I certainly agree with it. Now, what does he mean by fairy tale? He means that it ought to be a world so unique, so original, so surprising, so enchanting, that you utterly believe in it as though it were real. And perhaps that imaginary, enchanted world is even more real than reality, because it defines the essence of who we are as human creatures, our capability to have that, to have those parallel worlds that only we can create. And therefore, he used to say that imagination was reality to the X degree, meaning the quintessential nature of our reality was there, right there in our imagination. And I think that was clearly my attraction. First, literature was literature as an enchantment, and then to Nabokov in particular, because contrary to what everyone thinks to this day, actually, he very much remains the writer who believes that the best novels are fairy tales. And I wanted to show that and bring it out again to say, no, when you look at Lolita, when you look at Ada, there's much more than just the plot line. The whole experience of the modern novel is just really going beyond the story and discovering this vastly, richly, infinitely textured world where so much is happening, there's so much light that's gleaming, so much imagination is at play. Lolita, in a way, is entirely about imagination. There's almost a question as to how much Lolita really exists. She's entirely a creature of his fancy. She becomes this creature, this remarkably vivid creature, entirely through his imagination.
So how did you start to get Nabokov? How did you start this journey of yours? Because you get very close to the mystery, don't you?
You know, I think all Nabokovians are secretly slightly mad because we all believe we have a special connection to the writer. But I think that's what happens with artists or musicians that we feel close to, because literature and music both have a very unique way of just permeating through the fabric and the texture of things and really getting very close to us. Just you begin to breathe music the same way you begin to breathe literature. And I think as I read Lolita, as I read Ada, I realized that my experience of the living world was changing. I was looking at America after having read Lolita very differently. America became more interesting. I mean, I remember he talks in Lolita about the honest density of the colors at a gas station, the honest density of her shades, to talk about the color, I think, even of the pump. And just the expression honest density carries so much from Edward Hopper going to Lolita to today's America and some of its colors, some of its moments of beauty, that I realized that really that experience as a reader had become inset in my mind to the point that it was transforming my experience of the living world. And that's a very Nabokovian concept. He believes that great art, like for instance the Russian writer Gogol, when he saw St. Petersburg and described it, he saw it as green. He was the first person to think that the leaves of tree were no longer green but blue, for instance. And those shifts were so critical and so brilliantly seen that Nabokov says St. Petersburg has always changed since Gogol wrote about it. The very text is not just our perception, but taking it one step further, it's actually the city itself that changes. And I could say that for America, which was such a special place for Nabokov, it was the place where, for the first time in his life, after having left Russia in exile and then again left Europe because his wife was Jewish and he had to flee the Nazis, in America he found his happiness again. In America he found a synthesis of Russia, the Russia of his childhood, and sort of the dreams, his dreams as an artist in his adult life, to synthesize here in America. And in that sense, I think America was critically important to him as a man and as an artist. And the way that Nabokov transforms the American experience for me has been essential to my own life in America as a young writer.
You mention in your book that invent was one of Nabokov's favorite verbs. How do you go about inventing? How do you go about writing, Lila?
I think discipline is one of the key words. I would say discipline, willpower, intent. I think doing it every day is extremely important. It's almost like exercising, I would say. The other thing, I've always felt that there's this notion that about creativity that you just put something on paper. Yet a musician wouldn't work that way. And I've always been very interested in music. I've practiced music for many, many years. And, you know, you would never just compose or assume that you could put some notes on paper. You have to structure it and think it through before. And I think one of the crucial components of writing for me is actually the architecture. I think of architectures and structures before I even begin to really, I have a notion, an intuition of what I want the book to be like. But really, the architecture building, I like building the house first and then thinking about the color of the curtains.
How did you come up with the chapters for The Enchanter?
For The Enchanter, I wanted the book to be extremely playful. I wanted the form to be playful because I thought Nabokov just detested very serious disquisitions and essays. And he would have hated a book, I think, trying to show that he was a great writer of happiness and a very serious essay. So that's why I thought of combining fiction and essay and making everything. We have photographs in the book and draw in the book and drawings and games even, and a lot of games with plays with font. And I wanted each chapter to be one idea of happiness according to Nabokov. And I do think that it was the one thing that had been overlooked for many years. Nabokov as a writer of happiness. And I was very fortunate to meet many, many times with Dmitry Nabokov, his son, before he passed away a couple of months ago. And I did ask him what he thought about this project before I got started, and he agreed that happiness was a subject that had been widely overlooked by readers of Lolita or Ada, which to me is the great book it's almost a treaty, is a summation on the nature of happiness. So that was important to me. And then in 2006, I interviewed Updike, and I asked him about it, because Updike had this beautiful sentence in The New Yorker. He had said, he had talked about Nabokov, and he had talked about the crunch of happiness, which is one of my chapter titles. And I asked Updike, I said, well, what do you think? And he said, absolutely, I think Nabokov is very much, in many ways, the writer of happiness and ecstasy as well. And so those two, in a sense, I had the feeling that they, Dmitry Nabokov and John Updike, both gave their blessings, in a way, to get me started on this very perilous adventure, because there's so many Nabokov fans out there, and very many people have a very personal relation to Nabokov. So that if you're telling a fictional story where you're meeting the great writer, you're having conversations and dreams about him and reliving his world and reinventing, in a sense, his universe, well, I thought people might get very proprietary and very angry. But for some reason, they have actually been sensitive to the light and what I wanted to communicate of light, playfulness, and enchantment, which is something very contagious. He was a man who loved to, in the same way that his writing was contagious, he loved to laugh. He went to the movies all the time. He adored comedies. He laughed uproariously, and he laughed so much that people around him always laughed because of his laughter. And there's something of that that I wanted to capture in my own book.
In one of the footnotes, you point to another side of Nabokov, in that he could be quite dismissive and fairly set in his ways. And on Updike, you have him in the footnote saying, I do get annoyed when people I never met impinge on my privacy with false and vulgar assumptions. As, for example, Mr. Updike, who in an otherwise clever article absurdly suggests that my fictional character, bitchy and lewd Ada, is, I quote, in a dimension or two, Nabokov's wife. What about that side?
No, he was absolutely, he had sides that were unbearable. And I think one of the keys to writing a book like that, or beginning to think about the artist that we love and admire, is to have a lot of irreverence. And I think part of this book is a great act. It's a love letter to Nabokov, but at the same time, and a love letter to literature, but at the same time, it's a great act of irreverence, because he could be not only extremely dismissive of writers, but extraordinarily dismissive of women writers, or of translators. He says, and at one point I quote him in the book as saying, I am frankly homosexual on the subject of translators, which wasn't true. And again, everything Nabokov says, on the one hand, requires to be taken with a pinch of salt, but on the other hand, also just because he was exaggerating and whatnot, but on the other hand, sometimes he just blatantly contradicts himself. He did work with two women translators, for instance. He did teach Jane Austen in the end, although he said he thought nothing of lady writers, and so on. There was a part of him that admired Updike, and another part who got really annoyed because of that. But then he used to dismiss, and he was not very pleasant when he did that. And I think it's important when you draw the portrait of somebody you love to be very lucid about the darker shade in the painting. I have always dreaded reading in books, yet I'm about to tell the story of a handful of books which turned my fortunes. The adventures on which they sent me were entirely imaginary, or at least at first they were. They required no visits to reclusive Amazonian tribes or inhabitants of remote Muscovy. They took no toll on lazy feet and reluctant stomachs. After a brief spell of light slumber, eyes wide open, I collected myself. Soon, I was stretching languorously, getting up, sampling a tangerine, circling around the room on several random quests, pretending to ponder the beauty of an opening line before grudgingly making my way back to the couch. This time, I figured I might be better off sitting upright. Then it happened. The dread, the compressed letters of the alphabet dealt in terrifying order. On checking a few hours earlier, the verdict had been unequivocal. 589 pages. The horror. I ran in my mind a line by Hobbes, whom, as a matter of general principle, I'm not used to quoting to myself. Quote, if I had read as much as other men, I should be as ignorant. Unquote. Hobbes reassured me, alas, very briefly.
Leyla Azam Zangane is the author of The Enchanter, Nabokov and Happiness. She spoke with Voices of the Middle East and North Africa contributor Amir Sultani. To learn more about this week's program, please visit vomina.org or jadalia.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
for this week, this has been Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We look forward to your comments and suggestions. You may reach us by email at vomekpfa@yahoo.com or by phone at 510-848-6767, extension 632.
You can download the podcast of our program on the archives page of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa at kpfa.org. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Join us again next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.